DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon. Today's show spans 5 different countries and a variety of science topics that can directly impact your life today, either positively or negatively. The first one is about mental health. Now, nearly everyone knows someone or knows someone who knows someone who has suffered from depression or bipolar disorder. And if you do know someone, then you might want to alert them to this next report. Since one of the major indicators of a person's mental state is sleep, how much or how little or the quality of it, doctors in the Czech Republic believe they may have come up with a tool that can help predict the onset of a depressive or bipolar episode. Rob Cameron has more from Prague on these new electronic wristbands.
Those one are clinical ones, and in the basement we have the huge...
Dr. Philip Spaniel gives me a guided tour of the National Institute of Mental Health, a state-of-the-art neuroscience research facility on the northern fringes of Prague.
And right now we have the National Program of Sustainability.
Dr. Spaniel is a psychiatrist and researcher with over 20 years of experience in the fields of psychotic and mood disorders. He's also one of the pioneers in the field of relapse prevention, trying to find ways of heading off bipolar or depressive episodes in patients with a history of mental health problems.
Bipolar disorder is very prevalent, you know. This is 1% of the population. This is much more than those who suffer from diabetes mellitus first type or those who suffer from Alzheimer's disease or epilepsy or multiple sclerosis or something. You know, this is really prevalent. Once you are diagnosed with bipolar disorder, you can experience 1/3 of your life in any kind of affective episode, either depression, majority of cases, or mania. So that you can imagine what kind of burden it is.
For a doctor like yourself, who has a patient who is perhaps bipolar or is suffering major depression, presumably you are simply relying on your own intuition that you say, okay, I would like to see you once a week for the next 6 weeks and we'll see how the medication's doing and you'll tell me how you're feeling, etc., etc. So at the moment, you're not really getting any real-time data at all, are you?
Yeah, so that you just rely upon the face-to-face contact, which occurs not weekly, but once in 2 or 3 months, you know. So the data which you have are not sufficient. And this is the solution, you know, so that thus using this wristband actigraph, you can track the changes on a daily basis, you know, so that thus you can track the minuscule changes which precede the relapse of affective disorders, but also schizophrenia.
The wristband Dr. Spaniel refers to has been developed in conjunction with a company called MindPax. Here he's discussing the latest data with MindPax's CEO, Pavel Nevitsky. The wristband is what they call actigraphic, a non-invasive method of measuring a person's rest and activity cycles. It's similar to the activity trackers that so many of us wear these days. But as Pavel Nevitsky explains, its sole function is to measure the pattern of sleep.
Inside the wristband is an accelerometer. And through detecting the motion, we have developed the algorithms that can also identify when the person has fallen asleep, how long the person sleeps. And it regularly sends this actigraphy data on his sleep or the physical activity 3-4 times a day through the mobile phone application to the data storage where already the mathematical formulas are being calculated.
For mental health specialists, sleep disturbance is by far the most useful indicator that a patient is heading for an episode. If a doctor knows this, he can intervene as soon as the information pops up on his computer screen by increasing medication, for example, rather than the patient being hospitalized because their mental state has already severely deteriorated. So far, 400 people, psychiatric patients, sleep disorder patients, and a control sample, have used or are using the wristbands, allowing Dr. Spaniel and MindPax to gather 60,000 individual days and nights of data. And Dr. Spaniel says the data is already yielding results.
Recently, we were looking at the records of the patient who in the initial stage of mania. And it was really clearly visible, you know. The length of the sleep was decreasing and the motor activity was increasing, you know, so that there was a kind of scissor effect, you know, and it was so apparent. Right now, even from such a simple approach may bring the substantial information on your patient, and this is very apparent.
He and MindPax are currently in the process of applying for two separate EU-wide patents, one for the data collection system, that's the wristband and its mobile phone app, and a second for the algorithm that analyses that data. The cost of treating mental illness in the EU alone exceeds 100 billion euros per year, so the potential for the wristband is clear. Dr. Spaniel believes this simple early warning system could help by setting alarm bells ringing before it's too late. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
Well, we are going to stay on the topic of wristbands and alarm bells by introducing you to a very different kind of health device to wear around your wrist. This is the Pavlok Shock Watch, and as its name implies, it uses an electric jolt to encourage people wearing it to change their behavior in a positive way. Wolfgang Stuflesser has more in this report, voiced here by Gabriel Borud.
Want to get woken up with an electric shock? If it sounds like a masochistic idea, well, it kind of is. We're talking about 150 volts supplied directly to the sensitive skin of your wrist, and it hurts. At first glance, the Pavlok shock clock looks like an ordinary watch, except that where the numbers or hands of the watch might be, there's a lightning symbol. On the underside, two metal contacts rest directly on the skin of the wrist. You can control the whole thing with a smartphone app and enter an alarm time. If you'd like, you can set it to activate a tone. Or a light vibration. And then, of course, there's the electric shock. You can actually choose all three, one right after the other. First vibrate, then snooze, and then comes the sound of the alarm. And if you don't hear it, you'll end up feeling it. Manish Sethi developed the Pavlok. He believes there's great potential in driving away bad habits through employing a little pain, as he said in an interview with the broadcaster ABC.
There's a real power in using a little bit of pain to help you break your bad habits.
So it's essentially based on classical behavioral research. The key word here is Pavlov. More than 100 years ago, the Russian physiologist Ivan Pavlov carried out his famous experiment using a dog. Whenever it was mealtime for the animal, Pavlov would ring a bell. It didn't take long before he had merely to ring the bell and the dog would salivate. Its body knew it was time for food. The watch's name, Pavlok, of course, alludes to this. The main difference, of course, is that this is a negative form of conditioning. Instead of thinking that a bell means food, making the subject salivate, late sleepers know that they'll get a shock if they don't get up. It's known as aversion therapy. Online, there are plenty of comments from people who have worn the watch, attesting that they no longer sleep in. Another model of the watch goes beyond just sleeping in and claims to break other bad habits. The obvious examples are smoking or drinking, but others say they've stopped grinding their teeth, biting their nails, or fiddling with their hair. Whenever such an urge arises, the user applies a shock and creates a negative association with that craving. Psychologist Greg Kaysen, though, has his doubts. Such a watch really would not work unless it was securely attached to the wearer. Otherwise, they would simply take it off. The shock watch costs around $130, or 115 euros, and it is certainly not to everybody's taste. For some people, it might be better to rely on that good old alarm clock. One that just rings and definitely will not harm you.
And that was Gabriel Borud with the report there by Wolfgang Stuflesser. The field of esports, or competitive video gaming, is absolutely a high-intensity affair. But are esports actual sports? In Scandinavia, the answer is increasingly yes. In a growing number of high schools, esports are now considered an official school subject. Karsten Schmista has more in this report from Norway and Sweden, voiced here by Charlotte Lomas.
A gunfight on the streets of the Middle East. The good guys versus the terrorists. Loud, brutal, and bloody. But of course it's just a video game. It's the sound of free time, of hour-long gaming, and sometimes, deep into the night, yes. But not always. In Scandinavia, it's also the sound of schoolwork, like at a Norwegian high school called Garnes Videregående Skole in the city of Bergen. Since autumn of last year, this school has had computer games, called esports, as an official school subject. Head of the program, Petter Grahl Jonstadt, explains.
Esports is a phenomenon in growth. We see a lot of kids, like youths, devoting much time and effort, and we believe it deserves to be taken more seriously. We have an educational foundation for this program. First of all, we see that computer games have been found to strengthen cognitive abilities like perception, information processing, and multitasking.
It began with a class of about 30 students and predominantly young teachers who were fit enough for gaming. Youth is important since the age limit for high-performance gaming peaks in the mid-20s. From then on, your reflexes slow. Radjonstadt doesn't view these things so drastically, though. After all, the teacher doesn't have to be better than his students. He should supervise them and, above all else, ensure that the 5 hours of weekly e-sport training at school are not simply squandered.
2 hours will be used for physical education. In Sweden, I know they use yoga in order to ready the pupils physically. Then we will use the remaining hours to train technical competence and communication, cooperative skills, practicing their ability to function together as a team.
There's even nutritional consultation for the students, since being healthy and in good shape means a chance at playing at the highest levels of the esports scene. And that is the goal for these Norwegians, but also for Swedes as well. In Sweden, esports have been a part of the curricula at some of the leading schools for even longer, like at Voxnadalen High School in Edsbyn, roughly 300 kilometres north of Stockholm. Gustav Stromberg is an e-sport teacher, and he defends the subject just as he does his students. They are not nerdy loners sitting at a computer, he says.
It's exactly the opposite. E-sports work against these stereotypes. I mean, when you train for e-sports, you're playing as a team, you grow and become more social. All the things that are negatively associated with computers, they disappear with us.
He even goes one step further, saying he really, truly feels the subject should be called an e-sport.
E-sports are only different in that they're digital. That is new. Otherwise, they've got a lot in common with other kinds of sports, even if you can't always totally compare them one-to-one. But at the highest levels, you need very good strategic thinking, quick reflexes, and a general outstanding command of your body if you want to become one of the best.
Anton is one of the esport players at the high school in Edsbyn.
I think the subject is really important. We also take trips together to go to competitions, and we train for that. That definitely means a lot to me. It's like a dream come true.
And many parents also agree. This is a way that gamers can shed their image as belonging to the realm of the nerds. Because these aren't just some oddball kids who fled the real world for a more brutal artificial one. The official recognition of esports as a reputable subject of study shows that esports really are more than just a game. They challenge the head, the body, and the senses.
Here, with esports, I am really motivated to keep getting better. I want to play in the big leagues and make money at it at some point. That would be amazing. If I could, I'd be doing it all day, full time.
One of his idols is Emil Christensen, known online as Heat On. Christensen is an ex-professional player of the video game Counter-Strike. Today, he's the manager of an esports clan called Ninjas in Pyjamas, a group of gamers legendary both in Sweden and beyond.
Sweden's way ahead of the curve because we have a long history of well-known gamers. And that's why esports are becoming more and more accepted socially. The earlier image of your typical video game player wearing black and sitting in the basement all day long, and that's gone. We're putting ourselves out there. We've got good internet cafes and lots of people working on developing this board even further.
And that has been happening at schools for some time now, in Sweden and Norway. In fact, it's totally normal.
And that was Charlotte Lomas there with the story from Karsten Schmista in Scandinavia. Well, with the weather becoming more summery up here in the Northern Hemisphere, many of us will be heading outside to engage in some more traditional sports, whether it's biking, jogging, going on walks or hikes, or even tossing a frisbee. Unfortunately, many researchers predict that 2017 will be one of the worst years on record for Lyme disease infections, which is spread by ticks. Ticks, again, just a reminder, live in moist and humid environments, often in or near wooded or grassy areas, in leaves or in shrubs. Now, in Europe, ticks and the Lyme disease they carry are a growing problem, especially in Germany and in France, where it has reached epidemic proportions with 33,000 new officially confirmed cases in France last year. And the expert estimates, by the way, are four times higher. John Lawrenson reports from the village of Foucherolles in central France on the spread of a disease whose symptoms range from extreme fatigue to joint pain, memory loss, and paralysis.
A nurse arrives at the home of the Gelez family. Their eldest, 12-year-old Constantine, has Lyme disease and must take antibiotics for a year, this month intravenously.
I'm a girl guide, so I get a lot of ticks in the forest. I didn't have the red ring that often appears around a tick bite when you get Lyme's disease. But then the symptoms started. My eyes hurt, my joints too. Above all, I was exhausted all the time. It was then that I did a blood test and tested positive.
Catch it right at the start and you can hit Lyme disease on the head with a week of penicillin. But as Constantine's story shows, getting the right diagnosis is not easy. There are probably very many people who have the disease and do not know it. And for many that do is the fear of what this disease in its worst form can bring. This is Constantine's father, Philippe.
For my wife, it's really hard. She's afraid.
She's afraid that there could be long-term effects for your child.
Yeah. Especially neurological effects. Mm. She has friends who were touched by this disease.
And it went badly?
Really badly. They get handicapped.
On
wheelchairs. So for it's really hard to bear. That is why she has not come with us, because if she begins to speak about this, she will cry.
When I go to meet Professor Christian Perron, probably the foremost Lyme specialist in France, he's just finishing up with a patient whose condition is the one many Lyme sufferers fear most. 18 years she's been suffering from the disease, she tells me, several of those in bed. Now, thanks to Dr. Perron, she can walk, albeit with a Zimmer frame. This woman's disease was never picked up by the blood test that many doctors say is unreliable. For many years, she was told she had a mental problem. Says Dr. Perron, she's not alone.
It's a real scandal because you have millions of patients suffering from chronic Lyme disease or associated diseases transmitted also by ticks. They are suffering a lot. They have great fatigue, pain that is horrible. They cannot work. They have cardiac, neurologic, psychiatric, joint problems, major problems. And the physicians perform the test. They say it's negative. So they say it's in your head. You are not ill at all. It's psychosomatic. And that's not possible anymore to treat people like that.
Things are changing, though. France unveiled a national plan for fighting Lyme disease last September that promises better prevention and more research and recognises the existence of a chronic form of the disease, unlike the medical authorities in the UK and the US, who remain sceptical. Everyone agrees, though, that you need to be careful. Step into woods like this one near Paris, and you can be pretty sure that lots of little creatures have smelt your presence and are crawling towards you to feed on your blood. Pierre Ecker, vice president of the victims group, France Lyme.
La tique, en fait, qui est, elle existe depuis...
Ticks have existed for at least 100 million years. They sucked dinosaur blood. They don't have brains or eyes, but they do have receptors that detect changes of smell, vibrations, and carbon.
And that, dear listener, means you. Back with the Gelles family, it's supper time. Has Constantine's Lyme disease changed the way they see nature? I ask Philippe. Yes, he says. Now when they go for walks, it's long trousers tucked into socks and tick repellent sprayed around the ankles. And they're thinking of ending one family tradition. Because they won't change their uniform, they're thinking of pulling all their children out of the guides and the scouts. John Lawrenson, DW, Focherolles, France.
Have you ever been out and about and seen someone walking around holding a metal detector? There is something that's just fascinating about it, like a modern-day treasure hunt in a way, but it also leaves you wondering, what do they actually find? In our final report today, Kerstin Welter takes us to the beaches of South Africa and inside the treasure chests of two dedicated detectors.
It's 6 o'clock on a Saturday morning, just before dawn at Muizenberg Beach, the most popular beach for surfers around Cape Town. But it'll take at least another hour until the first of them make an appearance, and that's exactly what these two gentlemen want, the beach for themselves.
I'm Yannick van die Kerk from Cape Town, South Africa. I'm working at Correctional Service. This is only a hobby. Metal detecting is my hobby. I like it, and it's nice to find things on the beach.
Okay, my name is Henk. Been doing metal detecting for about a year now with Henny. We hunt as a duo partner. He does the water scene, I do the beach. Yeah, let's get going. Let's see what's happening.
The first happening is what comes out of the boot of their car. Machines which look like pimped-up crutches with little monitors and round coils the size of a plate at the end. Earphones, perforated shovels, headlamps.
So that's all your gear. What do you have with you?
My metal detector, CZ21, Fisher, and a scoop for scooping all the stuff out of the sand.
You have a wetsuit as well.
Yeah, I'll be going into the water.
Not scared of anything that might swim around at this time of day?
No.
That's why he's got me on the beach. I can't do the water, so he normally goes into the water and we kind of keep an eye on each other. It is early in the morning and people sometimes drink and you get the crazy people on the beach. So yeah,
really?
It happens. Yeah. You see some very precarious people early hours in the morning, people pulling all-nighters.
Today, the beach is quiet and serene while Henny and Hank start their hunt. That's what they call a sweeping movement with their metal detectors just above the sand, while listening intently to the sounds of their machines.
That means the ground balance is fine, and then you can start detecting.
Hank is the younger one of the duo, wearing a baseball cap, a hoodie and shorts. He's 35 and his regular trade is glass blowing. But one wouldn't know Hank's not doing metal detecting for a living the way he talks about it. The different layers sand forms over time, swallowing heavy objects like gold rings and releasing it with the tides. Or the conductivity of different metals, and the language of the metal detector indicating if there's something worth digging for.
Okay, you start learning the different sounds your machine gives, and also you use your screen to try and judge what it is. I've got a very nice signal there, it's 49. Normally that's a South African 5-rand coin, so... When you're small, you want to find treasure. So this is the best way and easiest way to find treasure. For me, it didn't take very long. I found one or two coins in the ground and I was hooked. So, yeah. There we go. 5-rand coin.
Wow, 5-rand.
Well, it's not much, but it adds up. If you find 10 of these, you have 50 rand. So, yeah, it buys for the beer at the end of the day.
Hank's laughter gives it away. He's a treasure hunter by vocation and digs for everything which seems promising, but not without a sense for life outside the earphones. He's married, endures the heat from the glassblower's furnace on weekdays, and goes metal detecting every Saturday since he got hooked on the hobby a year ago. Sundays are for the missus, he smiles, and concentrates on the beeping sounds in his earphones, while a few meters away, Henny wades into the water in his wetsuit. With his weather-tanned face, the piercing blue eyes, and the grey beard, he looks like a Captain Nemo. Henny is 59, Afrikaans like Hank. The two share a passion for history and things lost long ago, which tell stories from the past.
Have you found something?
Just a foreign coin.
Do you have any things when you say, oh, if I find this as a first find, it's always good luck?
No, I just go all out for everything. Gold, silver, coins, and my oldest coin is 1788 coin that I pick up. Yeah, and in a week I pick up a gold ring. All my stuff I find, I keep it. I never sell it. The usual coins, South African coins I used. Yeah.
I heard for a beer afterwards.
Beer or for petrol money or pie or something like that.
What was the most valuable thing that you ever found?
I pick up a men's ring, 18 karat gold. I keep it in a display case at home. In 3 years, I pick up 25 gold rings. All the rings is about 180 rings.
So you're lucky.
Yeah, it's all this depends on the luck. We're going to see what is here. I don't think it's something very good, but we've got to see.
2 hours into their hunt today, Henny has only found worthless stuff, but he clearly remembers other discoveries.
It was my second hunt out. I walk with my machine. I hear a very good sound, and I asked my wife. She was going to sit in front of me because there's people on the beach, and I know it's something big. When I put my hand in the sand, a long knife about 12 inches long just missed my arm, and I see there's two bags in the sand. And when I pick up the bags and I open it up, it was a goat's head, only the head. And my wife, she gets frightened, fall on her back. Yeah, it was still fresh. Now, somebody cut off the head of the goat and buried it there with that 12-inch knife. That was my craziest thing I ever found on the beach.
Oh,
but
God.
That was very, very scary and crazy.
What did you do with it?
No, I put it back into the hole. I just keep the knife.
Some metal detectorists sell their finds. Henny and Hank don't. If asked nicely, they help in finding lost items, or they advertise rings with engravings on Facebook to find the rightful owners.
We don't really do it for money. It's pleasure because, I mean, who doesn't want to be on the beach at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday?
I know quite a lot of people who wouldn't want to do that.
It's much better than sitting at home. That's the point.
Metal detecting has picked up a lot over the last 3 years in South Africa, from 40 to 4,000 hunters, says Henny. As he tells me this, Hank suddenly starts waving frantically at us. He's found something.
Yes, boy! Congratulations!
It's a ring. It looks to be silver. There's a stamp. There's a big stamp. Cleo Blue 56. That's either a name or a jewelry brand or something, but it looks like silver.
Nice.
It's quite unusual. It's half a ring and half a bracelet. It's exactly the range for silver.
And my machine also high tone. Very, very nice tone.
Pushed by this valuable find, Hank and Henny continue scanning the beach, each a cigarette dangling from the corners of their mouths, challenging each other. But without jealousy, they're a team. While I'm exhausted, the two treasure hunters will continue their quest. And they will send me a triumphant text afterwards. Various rings, a gold chain, a silver earring, some bling jewelry and 150 rand, about 10 euro in cash. With that, they'll sit down for a beer, admire their finds and plan the next adventure on another beach or historic site. For DW, this is Kerstin Welter from Cape Town, South Africa.
Well, it might just be time to finally pick up a metal detector. On that note, I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in this week. If you have any questions, comments, or random scientific insights, please email us. We're at spectrum@dw.com. I also highly recommend that you follow us online as well. On Facebook, we are DW Science. On Twitter, we are DW_SciTech. And on our website, you can go to dw.com/science and get all of our great videos and stories that don't make it into this show. A very special thanks today to our technician, Gerd Georgi. And on behalf of all of my colleagues at DW SciTech, thanks for listening in and have a wonderful week ahead.